You podcasted for 90 minutes before hitting a wall and tumbling to your death.
Guy, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Now,
we have on the show today Adam Saltzman, who you may recognize from video games such as Cannibalt and Hundreds. How are you doing, Adam?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. How are you guys doing?
Great.
So I guess what impresses me most about Hundreds and Cannibalt is that they're great examples of how independence can be really creative and make fantastic gameplay, and you don't always have to have giant studios, mega budgets, and blockbuster franchises behind you. You can just have a sense of fun and passion in what you're making.
Oh man, well, thank you. I don't know, I mean, it's one of the... So I used to work for a larger company, and I've contracted for very large companies previously, and there's a lot of overhead. There's a lot of risks that kind of come automatically when you are trying to work for yourself, and there's a lot of hassle, and there's a lot of like ulcers that kind of come with that territory. But at least one of the reasons you do it is because you can be agile. And not in the software development process sense, but in the like acrobatic, like ninja sort of sense. You can be just hanging out and, you know, somebody can throw out an idea, even if that somebody is your brain, that at first sounds like a joke, but then you start to think, oh, you know, maybe this could work. And you don't have to go start a bureaucratic process to bring that thing to life and show it to people and start getting feedback and see if people like it and see if you know, see if the thing that was in your head is totally valid or not. You can just close what you were working on and start working on this other thing. You know, to do that reliably in the long term requires some discipline and lots of lessons learned and so on. But that basic thing of we can turn on a dime and handle or take advantage of or chase something that in any other large business environment would be considered way too risky, or maybe they don't have the resources available, or you're already tied down to this other thing. That agility makes it all worth it for me.
Does it come at the cost? Are you throwing away a lot of ideas that you wish you had pursued, but you sort of can't just because of the time investment that you don't really have?
Oh man. Yes. I mean, there's lots of ideas are thrown away, for sure. And some of them are thrown away. Most of them are thrown away because they're just bad more often than unachievable. And this, I don't know if this is just my personal taste or whatever, but I don't have any dream projects lined up right now where I look at the project and I go, this is what I have to make. I will not see value in my own work if I don't get to build this. But the only thing stopping me is I don't have $10 million and 3 years in a small studio to do it. Like my brain doesn't work that way anymore. And I don't know when that happened or why that happened, but, all the things that I want to build, I could imagine a scenario where they might eventually grow, up in a way that I would need, help to finish it. But, you know, most of the time it's really just, you know, there's some small thing that sounds interesting, or there's a friend has some small thing that looks interesting and maybe we're going to team up together, which is sort of where Hundreds came from, I think. You know, those are the things that really appeal to me right now. So like there is a cost at, you know, doing this independently and being quote unquote agile, but it's, for me, it's less a cost in missed opportunities and more of a cost in just all the overhead that comes with it and the discipline necessary to not constantly leapfrog between your own projects and all that stuff.
I think that discipline is hard to come by. That's got to be a struggle, right?
Like, if I've been making it sound like I'm good at that part, I apologize, because that is really not the case. But I don't even have any good advice about how to get there or how to do that. Just that it seems to be one of these necessary components for following through on this stuff when you are your own boss.
What kind of ideas do you have? And I don't mean like, well, I'm going to make a monster that runs around the world and dodge obstacles. I mean, do you see, like, are your ideas sort of gameplay mechanics? Or are they, like, sort of what scale, I suppose, is the actual question I'm trying to, like, what is the scale of your idea? Is it an idea that can be fit in any given project that you're working on? Or is it, like, a very specific narrative point of view that you want to do? Like, what happens more often?
That's a good question. I feel like it's really messy. So there's this idea, kind of what you're talking about, at least in game design circles, they talk about doing like bottom up design or top down design. Right. Yes. And like, there's this, MDA model, out of USC which is a very top down design idea. Like, you know, we're trying to express a setting or an emotion, and we need to suss out what are the rules that would help people feel that. And then, obviously, bottom up is sort of the opposite. Like, oh man, I had this idea for a physics thing that is just inherently interesting, and we're going to figure out where to go from there. Mm-hmm. Which is maybe, that's probably more like a Braid style or a Spy Party style, right, or something like that. And, I end up kind of with a mix of both. It ends up, you know, part of where Cannonball came from was actually a very top down idea at first. And it was this idea that, I thought it'd be cool if there was kind of an exciting 2D platformer that was sort of like a flood scenario. So water would be flooding in behind you, and you would be sort of, there would be a simple kind of physics and buoyancy thing. And so you'd be constantly in scenarios where you were like riding floating things up, elevator shafts, and then jumping out of windows and running across the next rooftop, and the water is always kind of like coming up behind you. But man, like,
you know, you just made somebody $1 million right now.
it was going to be so hard to make. I really didn't want to try and build that, and I couldn't build it. And eventually, you know, I started having some bottom up ideas for a different project later that were like, you know, oh, I think there's some bits and pieces of Super Mario Brothers speedruns that I could just take out. Mm-hmm. And, but then when I started thinking about what to do, how do we theme this? How do we put this in a scenario that makes sense? Why would you be doing this like speedrun type of movement and platforming? And then that top down, you know, the flood is after you type of scenario kind of came like sneaking back in. And it was changed up, you know, to be less, specific, I guess.
So was Cannonball an additive or sort of subtractive design process?
I think it oscillated in sort of the same way. Like initially it was like straight, literally, just a pleasant realization, like, oh man, I can make Super Mario Brothers, but I can just take away two of the three buttons you mostly press. And so that was very subtractive, right?
Right. Cause it's one button. You get to do one thing, and it is awesome. It feels great, though.
Speedruns, they do the same thing. Like, you watch, you can finish Super Mario Brothers 1 in like 4.5 minutes or whatever. And they're mostly just kind of pressing one button. There's a couple of, they'll break their motion a little bit here and there, but mostly they're pressing right and pressing B and tapping A once in a while. And it's super exciting to watch.
Well, super exciting to play that way too. In Cannonball, you get a real adrenaline rush because the faster you go, the more dangerous it seems, and the faster you want to go again.
Yeah, yes, and I like all that. So that step was like very subtractive. But then, when I started fiddling around with the design, I was like, oh, I wonder, you know, obviously we need something to make this interesting. We need things to spice this up. What can I introduce as interesting obstacles that are not from Super Mario Brothers, but are suited to this game specifically? And that was kind of an additive process. And then there was oh God, I'm running out of time and I don't know how to do a lot of this stuff. So that was subtractive again. And then it was like, there's a question of why are you running? What is the setting? Where are you? What's going on? And I have just a built-in tendency to, I can't remember what it's called. Somebody was talking about this recently, but there's like a school of level design or game design that's really oriented around this idea of, it was Ben Esposito, from, the formerly Giant Sparrow, the Unfinished Swan guys. And he was talking about how, video games need, skeletons, and how by which he means video games need animated enemies that are going to chase you, and you have to destroy them, and they usually have a scimitar. But another way of including a skeleton in your game is to do it Pirates of the Caribbean style, where you have. I hope he wasn't going to give this talk somewhere else. I'm like spoiling the best part of it. But,
still not the ideas.
Yeah, you can have these Pirates of the Caribbean skeletons, which are skeletons that are sort of like laying around in these poses that kind of like tell stories about what happened before they died. And that's something that I've always loved when I found it in games. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of old first person shooters, like Quake 2 has this great. I love the beginning of Quake 2, even though it's so stupid and it's so simple and it's so obvious. But there's just an escape pod and a gaping hole in the ceiling and a bunch of rubble everywhere.
God, it's great. Yeah.
But you have this great little skeleton of a thing where you're like, okay, I'm a dude. I was in that thing. Now I'm not. I'm not supposed to be here, but I'm here anyway. And you get like it communicates a lot of information really, really quickly and effectively, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the things I liked most about Cannonbolt was the end of the world was happening in the background on a parallax layer that had nothing to do with the actual action going on.
Yeah. And sometimes it crosses over. Like it was helpful. Right. It was where like the additive subtractive back and forth ended up. That was the most exciting part of building it is I was like, oh God, I'm going to need obstacles. I don't know what I'm going to do. Well, if I just make a cityscape in the background, that's boring. So what if there's also an alien invasion?
Like of course. You know? What else would be happening?
Yeah, like Futurama style. Like it's just a montage of aliens just rampaging around, leveling the city. I did some quick sketches, and it looked like it was something I was going to be able to pull off, even if I didn't do a super good job on the art. It was like this is a thing that I can make in an hour, and it would accomplish the goal of giving you a story and giving you a setting. But then it had this really great like. Almost like multiplicative or exponential effect where it was like, oh, there's like aliens are invading. That gives me ideas for actual gameplay systems now. Mm-hmm. So I needed another obstacle. And maybe one of the things is there is just artillery from whatever's happening in the background occasionally comes down in the foreground. Yeah. And so you do end up with an actual kind of like physical or systemic connection to the thing that was going on in the background that was only going on in the background to give you something happening in the background.
And you stayed really pure to that, to the idea of just running. You mentioned earlier, you didn't do any sliding. You can't in-app purchase a floating power.
Yeah.
You just run or die.
Yeah. And there's no guns or anything. And this is just, that's not to say that's the best way to do this, but to me, like, you know, growing up, a lot of my favorite games were games that are about going really fast. And that's just automatically interesting and exciting for me and for, I think, a certain group of people. And so games like Wipeout or games like Sonic the Hedgehog, where you had this sense of it's almost not even important that you're actually physically going fast in the simulated world, but you have this sense that you're moving ridiculously fast. And like in Wipeout, it's all just like dirty cheats. Like the field of view in that game, like the camera angle that they use in Wipeout is ridiculous. It's like the most wide, it's basically a fisheye lens. and you can see it in screenshots. If you go dig up screenshots of like, especially like the PlayStation, like one era Wipeouts, anything where you briefly enter a tunnel or a corridor, it's just like peeling out. It's like they took the camera angle from Traveling Between Dimensions in some sci-fi movie. And they just use it all the time for everything. And so, like, Cannonball is really, like, that feeling, that just, like, really basic, visceral sense of speed was really the main thing that I wanted to do. And as I started to build it, it became, like, I have like, notes on my in my notepad that are like, oh, these are things that I should add because the game won't be interesting without them. And then, you know, by the time the game had, like, three things in it, it was like, no, it doesn't need anything else. Mm-hmm. Is if I add anything else, all that's going to do is I'm going to have to make you move slower in order to give you time to react and think about which option is best in this scenario and so on. So stuff like branching paths and sliding and, I don't know, wall jumps and whatever else was seemed like really natural, obvious, interesting things to add, just ended up being kind of counterproductive to the what to me felt like the exciting or interesting part of the design.
So your process is definitely from a sort of a gameplay point of view rather than a code point of view, or like at the building.
I would say that my ideas come from a really wide spectrum or broad range, but when I start actually building it, I obsessively start with systems first.
Really? That's interesting. And weird. Why do you do that?
There's this old story of, I don't remember which Nintendo, R&D1, one of the internal Nintendo teams building Mario 64, and how for the longest time there was no level design in Mario 64 at all. The whole game was just this one room that had a handful of interesting obstacles in it, and it was referred to as the playground or something like that, or the jungle gym, or I don't remember what. Mm-hmm. And they just obsessively messed with the controls for this 3D platformer that nobody had really done effectively yet for however long the Nintendo 64 was delayed, I'm guessing, is how long they were working on getting jumping to feel real good. Mm-hmm. In 3D. And it worked. That game still feels really good. And it's a primitive 3D game from a decade ago, like, or even longer. It should not feel good anymore. And it feels pretty sharp. I remember reading that story years and years ago, and it had a really big impact on me. And I think, I don't think I'd do it necessarily because of that, but it's you know, for me personally, not focusing on any time I've tried to focus on the story or the world or the technology first. It's my work personally has been a dismal failure that never came to fruition. The only time I've had any luck getting anything out the door is if I do these systems first. You know, get gameplay working, get it so you can press a button and the thing that you're supposed to do that's supposed to be fun happens. And, you know, it's it's just this, you want to have like this safe bet, or at least for me, like this neurosis I have is I want, if I can get the version of the game that's like super ugly and just a bunch of boxes, if that's starting to feel pretty good, now I feel a lot more comfortable going forward and doing all of the almost grunt work on content at that point, right? Because I know there's a framework that it's going to go into that is reliable.
The funny thing is that when you're saying systems, you mean gameplay systems, not allocators. Like, I'm going to need a particle system, so I'm going to have an allocator that, yeah, you mean actual things that people interact with.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, really, like and I'm sort of lucky now. Like, I started finally, like, getting, like, kind of down to the nitty gritty and going, like, okay, I need to make some small games. I need to make some little focused projects. I need to get something done. I didn't have any technology to work off of, basically. So, like, Cannonball was built on a bunch of existing Flash game tech that I'd been working on for a year or two at that point.
Exactly where I was going. You make games, you're, it seems to me that the tools are secondary. Is that fair, really? Like,
yeah. Like, I mean, I certainly, like, if I'm building a prototype, like, I really, at this point, I personally prefer to work in Flash. Mm-hmm. Just because I happen to know it, and you can prototype really rapidly and sloppily in it, and it's totally fine. But if Flash wasn't available, I would probably be using GameMaker or Unity or something else. And I'm actually at least relatively competent, quote unquote, real programmer. I worked as a C++ programmer for years before I started going independent and doing freelance artwork and so on. So I have a reasonable grasp of quote unquote real programming languages and all that stuff. It's just frequently working in those mediums for me is counterproductive because I'm trying to get gameplay working that I can share with people right away. And sometimes C++ is a fine way to do that. And for me, at least, sometimes it isn't. Like, I think it's actually pretty telling that Minecraft of all things is like a Java web browser.
Right.
I hate Java with a passion, but it's,
I can't even tell why. It just doesn't feel right.
There's a lot to hate about, but it has, you know, it has client server stuff built in almost at a language level, and it has cross-platform support built in almost at a language level. And, any environment where you can get some or all of those, access to some or all of those things is really nice if you're just trying to make a thing so that you can see if it works. Mm-hmm. There's a famous, not to throw out another tangent, but there's this great story about this this ongoing 30-year-long aviation sort of XPRIZE style thing where they were trying to it was for non-powered human flight. So not gliding, like genuine human power.
Jetpacks. Without even
no notes. Chemicals, no motors, no nothing, no jet engines, no, like, it had to be human powered.
Big flapping wings.
Wow. Yeah, more or less. The prize was unclaimed for 20 or 30 years until somebody sat down and like looked at design as a high level, like, systemic problem, like just design as a process in this case. And most teams that were competing for this prize were doing a test flight like every March. And these guys showed up and they started building these like crazy, flimsy, weird bicycle-esque, glider-esque, prop driven things, but their workshop and their design was set up so they could do a few flights a week, if not a few flights a day. Hmm. And so they were just getting so much more data. They were making mistakes so much faster than their competitors. I think they had a working design within like 6 months or something like that.
Wow. Okay. So I've got two questions there. A, how the hell did that work? What was the working design? B, do you find using Flash makes you make a lot of mistakes in a good way?
I can make mistakes so fast in Flash. Like, yeah. I could have made, in the last 30 minutes since this podcast started, I could have made like 400 mistakes at least.
It's a fail fast language.
Yeah, it really is. And to me, I see that's how we learn. That's the only, that's the only way that we can really learn anything. There's a lot of, really strong arguments out there that, and I've seen it in practice before. When you succeed, when something works, it's often very, very hard to pinpoint exactly why it's clicking with people. Why is it, like, how many articles have been written about why is Angry Birds so successful? It's not one
that doesn't matter. Right. Yeah.
When something fails, you can often look at the wreckage and go, oh, that, you see that? That was that was bad. And sometimes it takes work. You have to investigate it, but you can learn concrete things that way. And if you only get to learn one concrete thing a year, which is, you know, the pace that I was on before I switched to Flash, and I was doing C++ and Python and XML and all sorts of whatever. I had not even started, like, I didn't even know if I was making any, like, I would work on a game engine for like a year, and I would have no idea if I was doing it right or wrong. There's just no feedback. There's no context.
Right. There is sort of a fetishism of the engine in our, in game work, I think.
Totally.
And I think ultimately that's like, that's bad. It's going to end up just being bad for anybody that wants to make a game, really.
Yeah, I mean, I can sort of see arguments going both ways. Like, I think for me, like, for practical purposes, if you're not practically testing your technology on a regular basis, then there's kind of no point to what you're doing. And the easiest way to practically test technology that's designed for making games is to make games with it. And for me, like, the tech that I build all my stuff on now is actually not even that I was building tech and testing it against games. I was just building games as fast as I could and then reusing the pieces that looked handy. And eventually, you know, in retrospect, looking back, going, you know, I've got, I think, enough useful pieces here to make a framework. But that's not to say, like, I would never, ever want to discourage anybody from just writing a bunch of weird code and seeing what happens. Yeah. Like, I think that's a super beautiful, amazing thing. But, you know, at least for me, when I was doing a lot of, when I was trying to write a C++ game engine or whatever, I was definitely in that mode or that state of mind or that kind of, my approach was very much basically, I think, based on fear. I didn't want the game engine to ever be done because then I would have to do some game design. and I would have to fail. And I couldn't deal with that very well at that point in my whatever. And I'm not saying that everybody who like writes their own game engine or whatever is doing it because of that or has that in mind. But at least for me, I think that was very true. And switching to a language that is just, lightweight and sloppy and weird. And sometimes, I don't know, I think we were talking about this earlier, but I often don't feel bad when I make mistakes in Flash because half the time it's not even my fault. You know, like it's something else is going on there. You know, you'd think that'd be frustrating, but it takes some of the stress off when something goes wrong.
It forgives you, or it puts you in a point of view where you're not pedantic necessarily about what's going on. You just want to get at the results. So you can't fetishize the process or the particulars of what you're working on. Instead, you just keep building and keep chipping away until you get the actual result that you want.
Yeah, I mean, and part of it, I haven't talked about this that much before, but I really think that part of it is that Flash is not, like Flash has obvious limits. There are certain things that I'm never going to be able to do with it. There are certain roads that are the payout for going down that road is just not great. You know, it has constraints built in, and those are good anytime you're making stuff. The thing that's great and amazing and mind blowing about C and C++ is there's no constraints there. You know, you can have a game engine that runs at 500 frames a second if you want, if you're willing to spend enough time on it. And it's like that rabbit hole. I've been, I think, all the way down to the bottom of that rabbit hole in Flash, and it took like a week, maybe 2 weeks. And you get down to the bottom and you just go, oh, okay, well, that's where we're at. Nice. And I mean, you could do that for a lifetime in a quote unquote real programming language.
Don't use real and don't use the quotes because no, I don't personally like Flash and I think it's got problems, but calling it an unreal, you've made awesome stuff in it that it makes it real. Like there's no reason to sort of, diminish it from that perspective, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Well, and I feel like it's really unfair. There's still a stigma against Flash games. Like people will review a game that's not a Flash game and derogatorily refer to it as being like a Flash game or whatever, as if that somehow implicitly means something.
Does it matter?
You know? To me, it's just a platform, and it's a platform that has a set of constraints that align really nicely with the type of work that I frequently like to do. But and it has room to bend it. You know, you can make text-based adventure games in it if you want, and it's totally fine for that. So I don't know.
So do you like, is that like your go-to thing? Like if you wake up in the middle of the night and you have an idea, you go and you stand in front of like the Flash editor and try to knock out an idea. Is that your sort of go-to tool?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it's not, I don't know if it's so much that it's Flash specifically, but it's an environment that I know well. I've got a big, like anybody who works in any environment for a while, I have what is essentially a big folder of really handy stuff that already runs in that environment. And generally, like if I have a weird idea for a thing, as long as it's not, I will sometimes go to other places. I'll go to Java if I need to do stuff that needs like low level system access. Like if I wanted to write something that needed Wacom tablet input or something, like I would probably end up in Java. There's just no way to do it in Flash. Yeah. And sometimes I won't use my Flash stuff either. Sometimes like, just writing something in essentially native Flash that has nothing to do with Flixel at all. My like 2D pixelated game making library, I'll do that. Like Indie Game, the movies, Steam client was all built in just native Flash. And I've done like little, experimental games and stuff that are just in native Flash. It's whatever tool I happen to have a reasonable grasp on that is, I'll write, tools or experiments in processing if that's a better fit or that makes more sense. That's sometimes handy for doing stuff.
You know, explain processing. I don't think our audience is going to necessarily have a good grasp on it.
Yeah, processing is the coolest thing. Like, I'm not super fond of it, mainly because I'm not super fond of Java, really. But the guts of processing is this thing called the Sketchpad, which is a Java app that is a Java compiler, but it's kind of really specialized for the processing library, which is this great Java 2D, 3D audio, like serial port library that's really nicely organized, really nicely documented, and lets you do cool kind of audiovisual experiments and things.
It really is processing. It's like inputs come in, a bunch of stuff happens, and then they go out, and that's
But the thing to me that's still like the most like the stroke of genius for it is this Sketchpad environment where it's not like a normal programming environment. It's really more like a Notepad program that's been pre-configured to load up all the commands that you need to do cool stuff in processing and to compile stuff. And it even gets rid of, it hides like the file start, file end brackets that it turns out really aren't necessary for writing cool little experimental programs anyway. So it's very minimalist. And surprisingly that like absolutely hugely appeals to me. You know, sometimes you'll have a weird idea. You want to open up like a bunch of images that are in a folder somewhere and make them all black and white and something else in a specific way, or combine them or something. And you know, frequently processing is like way the easiest, fastest way to do that. But yeah, whatever the task is at hand, you know, whatever tool is easiest for me personally, not necessarily objectively the best tool is right. the one that I'm going to pop open. And for a lot of systemic experiments or gameplay experiments or, things like that, rendering ideas, Flash is almost always the thing that I pop up, but I never work in the animation tool. I just have an IDE that compiles ActionScript.
Oh yeah, so you don't use the actual time frame based?
No, okay. Never, okay. Never, ever, ever. I don't even have it installed.
Wow, really?
It may be like people who do a lot of animation may feel really differently about it, which I totally appreciate. But for programming, it's the worst tool, like ever.
I've had to use it. Yeah, I know. It's
like I can't think of like if I had to sit down and I was paid to come up with a worse way. I don't think I could.
No, I've been paid to work in that thing, and it's awful.
Yeah, I did freelance like ASP exactly. work back in the day, and it was there's a reason I'm not doing it anymore.
Although it was the only way to get that stuff on the web for a while, so a lot of us were forced into bounded slavery to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I started learning ActionScript with the thing that turned into Haxie now.
Hmm.
It was like an open source ActionScript 2 compiler. That ran way, way, way faster than Adobe stuff. And you could just type up a little XML file to tell it these are my source files. These are my graphical assets. And then you could just write ActionScript 2 in a regular text editor and compile it on the command line and run it. And that's actually how I started learning how to do ActionScript 2 stuff. Cause I couldn't afford the animation program. I hated working in it anyway. The pressure from that app, there were like major commercial studios were actually going through and replacing their Adobe compilers with this like free compiler that was actually starting to add features to the ActionScript 2 language. And then suddenly a few months later, we got proper ActionScript 3. I'm sure it's totally unrelated.
Where do you see that sort of accessible prototyping environment coming from next, given that it appears that Flash is on its way out? Is that even a fair thing to say? Do you think that Flash is going away?
I think that it's the limits of what it can do and the sort of competitive value of other development environments are rightfully mm-hmm. and justifiably putting a lot of pressure on it, mm-hmm. but it's one of these, I can't remember.
It'll be around in its way sort of thing. Yeah.
This idea, like once something reaches a certain mass or a certain size or a certain install base, like it just, if it goes away, it just takes so long. Like, I mean, how many copies of like Internet Explorer 6 or whatever are still out there, right?
It endures like ActiveX is what you're saying.
Yeah. Like every underlying component of Windows since the 70s, right? So things definitely stick around. But that said, I think I think both JavaScript and C# have some really interesting kind of competitive advantages over ActionScript in different directions. Mm-hmm. I feel like JavaScript is actually like messier, which is interesting for a few reasons, and can kind of be interpreted on the fly, which is pretty cool. And C# is just a nicer, but in some ways stricter and more powerful language on the other hand. And so those are kind of cool. And then there's the Unity web player is kind of gaining install base.
Unity really interested
me. There's like native client, which is like a whole crazy other thing. And so for me, it's really hard to say for sure, but I'm my friend Ivan's working on this thing called Polycode, which is like a nice standalone Lua based, you know,
really?
Unity-esque kind of a thing, which is pretty cool.
I want to see that.
Yeah, it's really neat. I think there's, I think people will see a lot more of it in a month or two here. But I don't know. I think the idea that I feel like as soon as people started making really nice, accessible game making tools, people realized how great nice, accessible game making tools are. And so I'm actually really worried about there being a shortage of like nice, accessible game making tools in the future. Like, I don't know exactly what form they're going to take, but stuff where you can draw a bunch of things and write some simple scripts and throw them together and put them up on the web or put them on your phone are going to be really common.
Yeah. One of the interesting things is that I find when people set out to sort of make that kind of tool, it doesn't really work. And yet when people just hack together a bunch of stuff, it does kind of work. Like, I mean, like Flash isn't designed to be a game tool, but it works really well for people who just want to sit down and knock something out. Games are weird in that if you try to sort of build a framework upon which to build them, it's almost confining. Like it doesn't work as well as sort of like this really loosey goosey, just.
Yeah. Well,
go wild. Go ahead.
In my experience, I think that part of that, or a big part of that, is really just that, part of it is this thing we were talking about earlier about like really practically proving out that your framework does make sense, that it is a good thing to do. So, you know, for Flixel, there's a lot of stuff that I use in a lot of games that I just don't put in the framework because I think it's too tautological, or it's too, you know, encourages or forces you to do things a certain way. And it's really not the only way to do it. And it's not the only interesting way to do it. And so I like for people to connect dots when they're using a framework. And I know that's not what everybody wants to do, but there's lots of other frameworks where you don't have to do that. But, you know, I think you, even though I tried to keep Flixel really, I thought when I was building it, man, this is great. This is really generic. It's really open. People can build a lot of different things in this. And I've seen people build a pretty good variety of games in it. You know, the vast majority are like Super Nintendo platformers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the more that I looked at Flixel, the more I could see like, oh, this framework is basically telling people to make this. Like, this is the lowest,
right?
Because it has the lowest friction, you know, like if you start playing around with it, the thing that gives you the most results the fastest, you know, they tend to have a lot of similarities, which, and you know, I understand how that happened and why that happened, but it is a lot more restrictive than I thought it was. Even if technically, formally, it's not, that you can make really weird, you know, like there's some stuff I've made in Flixel that really doesn't look like Flixel games or act like it. And it's stuff that is really very much built within the confines of Flixel and taking advantage of stuff that Flixel does. But, you know, there's more friction when you do it that way, for sure.
So the way you're talking about this, it sounds as if you have a sense of responsibility almost. Like you designed the tool and the output is guided in a certain way. And you seem, almost sort of not sad, but that you've robbed people of, or you haven't given enough of a platform, really. Is that how you feel about it too, or what?
I guess a little bit. I mean, it boils down to, like, I think of, and from every software library I've almost ever used, like, it appears that this is not a common stance, but like, for me, API design is as much you know, human-centric design as anything else. You know, it's the same as user interface design or industrial design or any of those things. And that's how it should be treated. And that's how it ultimately functions. And so I do look at what it does and what its affordances are and where are the friction points in it and where are the places where it sort of subtly encourages you to do one thing instead of another. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's, you know, what's the language of it? Like at some point I changed the render functions were renamed to draw because if you work in computer science, you totally understand what someone means by render. But if you don't, like, you probably understand what someone means by draw. And so probably that's just a straight up better name for, so what, you know, that behavior.
So what was the impetus for that?
Just wanting to make, a tool that, or continue refining a framework that, a broader and broader audience can use to build things. And this is something like, I think part of it is, you know, when you look at people who are doing creative work in computer fields right now, I think a really high majority, for me, like a really obviously tellingly high majority of those people grew up with some form of elementary computer programming toy, whether it was QBasic or even something like Visual Basic or, you know, a Commodore 64, or, you know, everybody had some kind of like weird broken, computer that had a really limited, interface. And in the case of BASIC, it was frequently intuitive. In the case of like hacking out weird assembly instructions from the back of a magazine, it was like not intuitive, but it was simple. There were only like 10 different things you could do.
Right.
That's just a good distinction,
by the way, is not simple. Not intuitive, but it is simple.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like, you know, it's just designing stuff for humans. Like if you have something and you just don't know, you just can't make it counterintuitive, you know, at least take away the number of moving parts.
Yeah.
You know, it's all different approaches to the same goal for me, which is to build or share things that are easy to learn, but are very powerful and expressive still. That's something that's like definitely an ongoing interest.
The way you design an API or an is that akin in some way to the way that you'd think about designing a game? The idea being that like there's a, you want simplicity and you want people to have a broad experience and like open a bunch of possibilities with a very simple setup. Is that a common?
There's this theory, and it's probably like Raf Koster was probably the biggest component or proponent of it for a long time, which is the idea that the fun of a game is learning. And I think lots of people have very rightly pointed out multiple times since then that that is a form of fun in a game. There's lots of other kinds of fun that are in the game, but, I personally love that part of a thing. I love the feel of learning something new and using that thing to do something kind of expressive or clever. And for me, whether that happens while you're programming or that happens while you're playing a game and you come up with a cool solution to a puzzle or something, or you figure something out, you know, even in something like Cannonball, you know, nothing in the game tells you that if you hit a box, you slow down and that allows you to regain some control over your momentum. If only briefly, like there's no tutorial or pop-up for that. But if you put enough boxes in the game at the right places, people find it on their own. And when they do that, I think it's just such a different experience for them. Like you get this, something that is, you can imbue something that is a necessary part of the system for sustainability reasons with a sense of mystery or discovery or something. Like, and you have to be careful about how you approach it, but I mean, that's what the design problem is all about. And that's not the only way to design things, but that's, it's something that I really that I personally find a lot of joy in when I'm playing a game. Mm-hmm. And I think it's naturally something that I like to put into a game or into an API. And for me, really the main problem of design for me, is frequently just figuring out the right way to show something new to someone so that they can teach it to themselves.
You're showing instead of telling.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, obviously it comes out in the hundreds level design a lot. And there's a whole spectrum of just, you know, leaving stuff, you know, I always use this anecdote, I guess. And I think it's from a Malcolm Gladwell book, and lots of people hate him, and that's totally fine. But there's a great anecdote in one of his books about, attention and the way people's brains work. And, it's a puzzle where there are two ropes, hanging from the ceiling, in a room, and they're pretty far apart. Mm-hmm. The puzzle is to figure out all the different ways that you can, tie the two ropes together. And you can't really just stand in the middle and grab both. You have to come up with some different methods or approaches. Most people can come up with like two or three basic ways to achieve it. And, in this trial or in this study, the researcher comes back in and says, you know, checks in to see how they're doing. They've come up with two or three solutions, and he says, great. Okay. You know, thanks. And walks back out of the room. And on his way back out of the room, he deliberately brushes up against one of the ropes, which sets it swinging from side to side just slightly. And, the test subject almost always immediately moments later goes, aha, I figured out the fourth solution. And they run over and they grab one of the ropes and they intentionally like throw the rope so that it starts swinging back and forth on its own. They run over to the, other rope that's hanging, grab onto that one. And then as the first rope oscillates back within reach, they grab it and tie it together. And then they interview them. So that's not necessarily interesting on its own, but what's interesting to me is after this little trial or this little test or study or whatever, they interview the test subjects and they ask them, oh, hey, so where did you come up with the idea for setting that rope swing so you could like tie them together? That was pretty clever. And everyone, like unanimously, every test subject says, oh man, right? I am so clever. It just popped into my head. Like, I don't even know where it came from, but I suddenly just had this epiphany. Like,
that's awesome.
You know, and I just knew how to solve it. I'm just a clever dude.
It's the power of hinting.
Yeah. So I think about that story a lot. And then I think about, there's a John Blow quote that's, maybe when you design games, you shouldn't make, instead of making people feel like they're smarter, maybe we should actually make people smarter. And so I feel like that previous anecdote and that John Blow quote are kind of constantly, in tension when I do puzzle design.
Because right. Is hundreds designed to make people smarter? Like, was that?
I don't know. It's something that I wanted to achieve with a lot of the puzzle design. And I don't know. I don't know for sure if it worked or not. Like the thing that I tried to do was always make sure that, and this I think is all you can do, is I would, you know, set the rope swinging in motion with part of the puzzle design, but try to make sure that whatever the real puzzle was, that it wasn't just arbitrary, that there was something real. Mm-hmm. Underneath it, you know, it was an insight about the way the changing radius of the circle affects an angle of incidence, or you know, I tried to make sure that there was something really legit under there, and that it wasn't just completely arbitrary or completely abstract or something like that.
It has its own internal rules that you still have to follow.
Yeah, and they're rules that connect to, they're like true rules. They're math rules. They're like physics rules. They're somehow, in some way, maybe more legitimate than something that didn't have that grounding, maybe, but maybe not. I don't know. There's lots of different kinds of learning. and lots of different things. Like if people's only takeaway is, you know, oh wow, like I was just constantly in a scenario where I thought I couldn't solve this problem, and then it turns out after experimenting for a while I could. Like if their takeaway is an increased desire to fiddle with things that they don't fully understand, that's, to me, that's super legitimate. That would be amazing.
Well, mm-hmm. It feels like when you're playing Hundreds that half of it is your attempt to understand the physics and reality of that universe.
Cool. Yeah, that's very, very much intentional. And to have it be, and it's sort of intentional too, that Hundreds is kind of a perfectly inelastic universe. It's like a test universe.
Where did the impetus for Hundreds come from?
I mean, it was all, the original game is, it began life, I guess, as a Flash prototype designed by this guy, Greg Woolwind, who's a fantastic game designer and graphic designer in his own right. And, my business partner, Eric, at our iPhone company, really liked the prototype, and Greg had open sourced it at some point. And so, Eric made a quick, build of it that could run on an iPad, just to see if it was like cool or interesting or whatever. And, it very much was. And, a lot like the Cannibalt scenario earlier, where a lot of people see Cannibalt and they say, oh man, this should have guns and helicopters. I looked at Greg and Eric's circles on iPad thing. I was like, oh man, like we should add guns and helicopters to this.
You added Ninja Stars. I mean, you went part of the way.
Yeah. Yeah. We got there. We were working our way up there. But yeah, I wanted to do something where we would explore, okay, there's circles bouncing around, but, I don't think we can make a whole game out of that, but we all, you know, all three of us feel like there's something here. And so let's try and explore it in a way that we think is like valid and interesting and cool.
It's very, all of you games actually have different aesthetics. Is that something you do consciously, or does it just sort of arise out of the team, or what?
I mean, in this case, I think it was very much, Greg was the graphic designer on it, and he has his own whole awesome thing that he does. And it came out of that really purely, but that was also something that I felt really good about, because I don't I don't think none of our games that we've released look very much like each other, particularly, on the iPhone at least. And, I certainly have I've developed a certain sort of look and feel to like pixel art Flash games that I tend to do. Mm-hmm. There is sort of a stylistic thread that runs through there, but, commercially and creatively, I think there's a lot to be said for, trying new things and doing different things and not being too predictable.
Stretching yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I like to learn new things. B, I like to at least imply that, you know, the work that I do or the people that I work with somehow is also kind of unpredictable and will be new and will be interesting the next, I think in some way it almost implies that, oh yeah, the next thing we make is going to be even more differenter. that's a message that I like, that I think that eventually begins to send.
Do you look at it almost the way a director looks at his filmography? You look at your gameography and you want to have a certain body of work that's different and sort of reflects different facets of you as a developer?
I guess not exactly. I mean, sort of like in some ways, sometimes I sit down and I go, man, I really, really want to finish a board game or a card game. Like I want to ship something physical. That's something that I'd like to do, but, game wise, I really just like, I definitely want people to look back on, you know, if I like basically exploded tomorrow, and there was, somebody wrote like, a nice article about what I had done pre-exploding, that it would be, that they would note that there was a breadth to the work, and that, and also that it was, that a lot of it was very accessible work. Like those are those, I think those are things that are important to me as a designer, is to make, it sounds really condescending if you call it this, but I would say it's, I'm lately, especially it's very important to me that at least some of my work be kind of humanist. Mm-hmm. So like, I actually consider, you know, Hundreds is like really sterile and austere in a lot of ways, but I actually consider Hundreds a very humanist
design. Got a weird dichotomy because, and you mentioned this earlier, you're ultimately responsible for your own demise in Hundreds. So you have that control over your destiny, but at the same time, that ratchets up the frustration level a little bit too.
Yeah. I mean, it's got the thing that I want. So, I mean, I like challenging games. I like games that are physically and mentally challenging. I mean, the game that I've probably played the most in the last few years is Street Fighter IV. just playing against random dudes online or whatever. But I know that the audience for Street Fighter is never going to be beyond a certain size X. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a cap to the number of people who are willing to put up with basically the constant stream of BS that that game feeds you in order to get to the good stuff. And the good stuff is really, really, really good. So like as a designer, I feel a kind of I'm going to call it ambassadorial guilt. That, like, I know that we've made all of these super interesting, wonderful digital games, and there's no way, they're great because they're digital. There's no analog component or there's no analog to these designs. And so, like, I feel like it's really important to try and make work that is humanist, aka it's intended for human consumption, and it shouldn't require video game literacy in order for them to enjoy it, but that it simultaneously, that it should be challenging and procedural and interesting and be the best of what digital games are and can be, but also actually be designed for people to play and enjoy without these barriers that there are a lot of barriers to entry in the act of playing video games. We don't always realize how high they are. And I feel like when you make a game that is humanist, but is not challenging and does not represent the best of what we do, that it actually misrepresents our form to our audience.
Do you worry a lot about the form of a video game, not a video game, but like the way that video games are interpreted by a broader audience? Is that something that you care about? You know what I mean? Is it like the comics code circa 1950s kind of feeling that you worry? Like,
no, it's almost the reverse. Like my concern with it is off. Like I identify with, like, there's a lot of really, I think, fully justified concern out there about the sort of implicit, like there's a lot of implicit bigotry in video games, and that does, you know, that like naturally upsets me, but, the implicit violence or, you know, whatever, what is it? Call of Duty were trying to give away, they were selling like combat axes with like the logo of the game on it or something, with like a so pre-order, awesome. Like actual lethal weapons. Like I obviously, like if I was into that sort of thing, I would be designing games where you could do that. But the thing that I actually worry about more, because I ultimately, like, the reputation of that reaches a wider audience, and I think that's not ideal, but like for me, the best ambassadors of what video games are, and because I just think they're interesting, and they're just things you can do in a digital game that you can't do in other stuff. And that makes them interesting and viable. And the fact that they're still considered to be, or are, in a cultural ghetto or dismissed by a lot of people definitely bugs me, because it hurts my ability to make work that reaches that broader audience. Right. And so, like, I do think it's really important to make this so-called quote unquote humanist work that represents our stuff really well. And I think when, for me, if I look at the broader swath of iPhone games or iPad games who are reaching not a wide enough audience. Like Flash games probably reach a wider audience still. Yeah. But iPhone and iPad are reaching this really wide audience of people who didn't play games before. And Facebook games did it before that. And it actually like physically upset me that there were a lot of people out there going like, oh, so video games now can either be murder simulators or Farmville. Like that was really, right or wrong. And I'm not saying like this should be an industry issue or anything, but for me personally, like that's just upsetting. I dislike that, a lot. And so for me, it's very much about, and Cannibalt was this way and it succeeded a little bit. And I think Hundreds actually succeeds at it a lot more. Can we take something, that is challenging and get it into people's hands who wouldn't normally pick up a challenging game because it's challenging in the right way. The challenge isn't how to interface with it because we don't have, you know, the idea that games have interfaces, you know, I'm an interface designer. I was a user interface designer for years and I obsess over the interface design of my games, but, a lot of my games don't have interfaces.
Right.
You know, Cannibal doesn't have one really for the most
true?
Part.
Isn't the game itself the interface? I don't want to get too trippy there, but...
That's what I tend to lean toward when you do that, when they're actually unified properly. I think it makes a huge difference. And because books don't have interfaces and movies don't. I mean, you could argue that like culturally there are schema that we develop through our exposure, blah, 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 blah. But generally, physically speaking, you know, there is they have less of an interface than most games do. And so I'm very interested in getting rid of that interface, but keeping not accidentally getting rid of all of the good stuff when you do that. You know, I don't want to accidentally, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
But the bathwater is super gross. So something's going to happen. You know, if we achieved anything with Hundreds as a team, like that's the, for me personally, that's the part that I feel just super good about is we reached this like really wide audience of people who are playing way harder. I think they're playing probably the hardest puzzles for some of these players that they've ever played in their whole life. And they're realizing that, oh, like this is, you know, hopefully they're realizing, oh, this is a thing that video games can be. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be exclusionary and it's not going to be mean to me because I'm not good at Legend of Zelda also. Like, but it's still going to challenge me and like, you know, require me to think and require me to like, you know, play the piano on the screen.
It's going to be authentic, but accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's what I'm interested in game design right now.
So one of the things you did recently, just to crank it up in the intelligence notch, is Old Spice commercials.
Yeah.
Which were kind of awesome. Like a lot of those games were pretty cool. How does that work? Like what's the process going on there?
Like creatively or business wise or?
Creatively, really, is what I mean. So Old Spice comes to you and they say, we want a bunch of commercials, a bunch of interactive Flash games to use as commercials. Go.
Yeah. Pretty much. And I mean, I had a good and a bad feeling at the start. Like they came to us very early, as in like before necessarily like the client was on board with the idea. Mm-hmm. And that always sets off some alarm bells in a freelancer's head. Cause you don't want to do a bunch of, pitch work or spec work for something that doesn't even have a budget. But I talked to them on the phone a couple times and they came to visit us in Austin. And, you know, these are a lot of the guys who are kind of responsible for anybody even hearing of Old Spice ever. Like, I mean, like 2 or 3 years, basically before Tim and Eric made those crazy, amazing commercials, which these guys like hired and arranged to happen. I don't think anybody except like me, because my dad uses Old Spice, had ever heard of Old Spice as a thing. like, actually had a good feeling because of that. Like, these are guys who have, like, they've achieved a thing and they did it in a non-traditional way. And that's pretty cool. This wasn't officially listed in the spec or anything, but like the general sense I got is, we're looking to do something that's a little bit in the vein of, it's in the style of, what they do at Adult Swim or something like that. Like, we want some kind of like, wacky retro action types of things. And I was totally into that. And it's another one of these things where it's like, great, I can reach a wide audience with these kind of games, and similar to Hunger Games, I'm very tempted to always see it as an opportunity to, okay, here's a big wide audience of people, but we could make good games still. Mm-hmm. Like, we could make this a thing where they would, play an original action game that would have maybe one or two small new ideas in it, but it could be really well executed and interesting in and of itself. And I think probably half the games or game mechanics that we ended up coming up with and using are kind of semi-legitimately interesting on their own.
What was interesting to me with the Hunger Games specifically is I saw it come out, and then I saw a bunch of people saying, hey, Adam, who made Cannibalt, made this game. And it made people who wouldn't have otherwise looked at a movie franchise game go and pick it up and try to play it. So it's almost like you have the huge mainstream audience on one end, and then you have, I don't know what the right term is, game nerds who are kind of anti-franchises on the other hand, and your credibility added to the game.
Yeah, and I mean, like, my team for this was, like, not your usual team of dudes. I have, like, a fine artist from Germany painted all the backgrounds, and Robin Arnott, who's pretty well known for doing some really weird audio work, like that freaky gas mask game, Deep Sea, is Robin Arnott's project, and he did all the audio for my kind of like quasi experimental game Capsule for Venus Patrol early last year. And so, like, I had a really not like this was not a normal, I think, like, commercial work group of guys sitting down to make games together, but we really, it wasn't like a pep talk or anything, but I was trying to, like, ease some of these guys who haven't necessarily done commercial work recently or ever, like, ease them into the idea of what we're attempting to do. I think I was talking to Robin specifically, but I was like, this is, all right, so we're making ads for deodorant.
Look up, look down, we're making ads for deodorant.
Yeah. But, we can elevate them, I think. Like, that's a legitimate thing that we can do, is we can come in here and we can say, like, yeah, this is like crazy Old Spice stuff, but the games are rock solid. Like, we ended up on, we were just a few slots away from making it into the Polygon, like, top 10 game of the year poll or something.
That should have happened. Right? Like, those games are great. No,
we got, I think, more votes.
It could be because they're ads. That's my thinking of it.
Yeah. We got more votes than Diablo 3. So, and that's not necessarily that they're better games than Diablo 3, but they brought something new.
Yeah, totally.
To a lot of people. It's like, it's a legit action game. B, the sort of the comedy that the agency and the animation studio delivered were really good, and we put them together and they often flowed into each other and made sense. And I was really happy with it. And especially our last installment was like a really, really authentic vertical Japanese style hardcore shoot 'em up, like space, like multiple layers of parallax, like just the right amount of delay, the right auto fire worked the right way. Like, we were really working straight within the conventions of a really niche thing. And it went out to a huge audience, and we got the feedback that I really liked to see, which is like, whoa, the dude bros are like, whoa, that game was crazy. The heck was that? But from like, NeoGAF or, shmups.com or something like that, like, mm-hmm. really people who are like really deep down into the gaming thing, they were like, whoa, this is like pretty legit. I think like shmups.com Twitter account which is like really, really hardcore, like Japanese shoot 'em up high score community oriented type site, mm-hmm. is like, you know, actually tweeted, hey, check out this confusing but free version. And I felt great about that. Like, we managed a week to make something that was, even to the, what I would say, you know, refer to people as like domain experts in that niche genre. We made something that qualified and was recognizable on their own terms. And it was still an ad for deodorant. You still shot deodorant rockets at a giant floating internet cat. Right.
But in the right way.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It was like, those weren't necessarily the most expressive games we ever did, but as a mechanical exercise and a way of refining, like, actually my understanding of how Flixel is laid out as a development tool actually changed a lot. And there are,
by putting it into,
just like, putting it under this stress, like, we were making a game a week.
Right. I love that too. That was part of the, I don't know if thrill is the right word, but I mean, it's like this. Well, it's cool. It's like a game a week. That's kind of, it's ballsy. It's yeah. a good, you know.
There was like a triple extreme sports kind of something, right? But yeah, it really pushed my tech in a way. And I was seeing weak points in the way some of the framework is laid out that I don't think I would have known about otherwise, which is kind of cool.
So you're going to go back and fix them, or are you just going to?
I hope so. There's some stuff that I don't know if I can fix, because I don't think the language lets me work around it, or I haven't figured out how to approach it in the language the right way yet. But a lot of the framework held up and proved itself out too, which was cool.
One of the things I found really interesting, I played a lot of Hundreds because I was traveling a lot recently, in that you didn't just throw it up on the iPad and letterbox it so that the 16:9 would kind of be in the middle of the screen. You made separate games for both devices, almost to the extent that they actually play differently. And I got in a lot of arguments with people over which version was better. Like, this one, your fingers are closer together, but this one, you can see the balls better.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was really designed for iPads straight up. Like, probably if we worked on it for 18 months, I would say for at least the first 12 months, maybe even 15 months, probably 12 months, we were planning it to be iPad only. Just because we had just assumed that it wouldn't even be playable on iPhone. What would the point be? But Eric, my co-founder at SemiSecret, did some tests and kind of tossed it on iPhone and was just like, well, here, let's try it. Like, let's actually let the things slide around and we'll put our fingers on the screen and see if it's even like remotely playable or enjoyable at all. And it kind of was. Like, we were both expecting it to just be straight broken, and it wasn't. And so we ended up spending probably a man month or something like that trying to get it to the workaround. There's lots of little tiny adjustments that were made for iPhone where we had to sort of animate a ring around the circle you're touching since your fat finger covers up the whole circle, and change the way the touches are interpreted to use kind of a more forgiving radius on iPhone, and so on and so forth. And then make some really big changes to a lot of the way the levels are laid out and programmed. And some of that's procedural and some of it's manual. And it was a really big hassle. But it was so much fun to just design for the iPad for so much of the game that I don't actually regret it at all. Like, I've never gotten to do work for like a Nintendo DS or like a really dedicated console like that before. And this is actually how we started out. And we started making iOS games like 4 years ago. So there was only iPhone.
Yeah.
That was the only device that was running iOS at all. It was like, there was only one model of it when we started. There wasn't like an iPhone 2.
Yeah,
it was iPhone 1 was the iPhone, and that's what we were making games. Or maybe there were two, technically. I can't remember. But, There was the same screen size and everything. Yeah, there was an iPod out there that was a pretty similar spec or whatever. And so we were doing really dedicated hardware work. So we were designing one interface and one style of controls for one really dedicated piece of hardware. And I felt like that was for our game Wordle. And I felt like it, you know, it made a difference. Like we were able to really tease out like the best configuration and the best design because we had this really constrained specific target. And so much of Hundreds was designing it to be just an iPad game that, I don't know, it felt good. It was really nice. Even my Flash games, I design almost all of them to have a fixed resolution mm-hmm. and to assume that they'll be played on keyboard and everything. I really like those. I really like being boxed in that way because that's the, like we talked about, you know, interface being this problem for normal people to play games and enjoy them. And, you know, the hardware is the interface. That's the whole thing. And if I can't design really directly for that, I think, it means that I can't achieve the goals that I'm trying to achieve generally.
It's weird because there's almost an analogy. I don't know if this is correct, but there's almost an analogy to me to the transition from television to widescreen to IMAX. Because in the beginning, you start seeing widescreen and you figure there's all this stuff I've missed on the sides for so long. And now a lot of people are shooting on IMAX and you're seeing everything on the top and bottom you never got to see. And playing with the iPad seems like that. It doesn't seem like you're missing stuff on the sides anymore, but that you're actually getting far more height to everything that you're looking at.
Yeah, well, it turns out for this game specifically, you know, Greg didn't design it to run widescreen on the computer either. And especially the way that we thought about, you know, the way that we framed all of our thoughts about puzzle design and level design and everything was all very much framed in this slightly more square mm-hmm. setting because the square bounds the circle really nicely. And it's a game about circles. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard to adapt to iPhone 4. And we basically didn't adapt it to iPhone 5 because it just broke the focus, the focus and the point of the game. Like the geometry just didn't work. There is a version of Hundreds I think we could make for iPhone 5, but it would be substantially different.
How much active design is there in those puzzles?
Way more than you might expect. way more.
I could kind of tell because it's yeah.
But and it was really hard. We went down a lot of wrong roads. We've thrown out at least as many maybe. If you include the stuff on paper, we've probably thrown out twice as many levels as are actually in the game. Right. That just didn't, I didn't end up being interesting or were just really thoroughly wrong-headed from the start. And this is something I did this talk at Game City and that was basically only about, all of the wrong, really fundamentally wrong ideas I had for puzzle design in this game. And it has to do with, sort of sustainability and interest in the way people learn and stuff. But at the beginning of Hundreds, you have a lot of levels that are kind of very geometrical and regular and kind of oscillating in a specific way. And they're sort of interesting then, and it's fine that they're rigid because you're still learning the basic rules of the game. But we were finding that we were having a lot of trouble sustaining the level of interest that was in those puzzle designs across a game that we intended to have 100 puzzles. If we kept trying to do these really rigid and prescribed puzzle designs, it just wasn't working. And so we spent a lot of, it took way, 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 way longer than it should have taken us to realize that we were really approaching it from the wrong way and that what we really needed to do was to change gears and to start designing puzzles that are a lot more like the puzzles that you do see at the end of the game, where there's just a handful of circles on the screen and some of them have certain behaviors and some of them have other behaviors. And the interesting thing is the way that they interact with their random velocities and random positions and how you deal with that as the person trying to solve the puzzle. That all ended up being the interesting stuff that allowed us to create a game that we felt like didn't have a lot of time wasters, and most mm-hmm. usually each, we try to make sure that each level has some small new idea or some small new twist in it. Shifting those gears and going with something that was random and emergent versus really deeply prescribed was a big deal. And the funny thing is I felt like doing random levels meant not doing design, but it just meant it changed where the design was happening. So the design wasn't necessarily spatial, but it was about picking out the ingredients that went into the recipe in the first place.
What do you take from Hundreds and Hunger Games and Cannibalt and Flixel? Do you have a through line that you're sort of discovering as you keep making things?
I guess I'll do that second part first. For me, it's that basically because I want to keep doing this full time. You know, the takeaway for me, and hopefully I have not been grossly misinformed because it'll be really awkward in a couple of years, that doing these so-called humanist designs actually is fine for business. Mm-hmm. It's actually really good for business. Like the idea that I had, especially specifically before Hundreds and in a nascent form before Cannibalt, the idea that what if I, you know, try to, in my own lame way or whatever, try to have this ambassadorial role and try to take the things that I love about video games and bring them to a wider audience, but without compromising the things that I think are really important. You know, that's not just, I don't just feel good about that creatively, like that's actually financially sustainable. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really good takeaway for me. Like Hundreds for me is really just reaffirming that idea so that hopefully going forward, you know, any project that I spend a long time working on will probably have this kind of humanist bent to it, because that seems to be the way that we reach a large audience, mm-hmm. which means that we can financially support ourselves, but also don't have to make compromises that are larger than I'm comfortable with as a quote-unquote artist or whatever.
Are there things you'd like to see from Apple or in future versions of iOS that would allow you to make better games or better fulfill your vision?
Oh, man.
Save the easy ones for the end.
I don't know. There's, you know, I don't have anything specific in mind, but I could point out recent things they've done that I like. They added this feature, I think, to iOS 6 where you can lock the home button. So if you have like a 23-month-old son who likes to play on the iPad but gets a lot of feedback from pressing the home button because it causes these like massive screen size changes to what's happening, you can kind of lock that off and keep them in a more focused environment for a little bit longer.
You can do that now. I think there's with iOS.
Yeah, guided access mode.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a cool thing that they added. And so things like that, little touches like that, I think are really nice. I think oddly, like probably their Apple's biggest contribution in some ways is just proving the viability of touchscreens, period, mm-hmm. you know, as an interface. And I think the big impact of that is actually going to be more affordable touchscreen devices going out to a way, 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 way bigger audience than Apple is ever going to have at their price point. And that's not to like, you know, especially like third world countries eventually and
emerging markets.
Yeah. Like anybody who doesn't just have like $500 laying around to spend on a shiny thing because they only make, you know, $50 a year, eventually there are going to be, you know, touchscreens for them to play with. And in my experience, it's such a low friction interface for people who are new to computers and digital things in general. Like even here, like my mom uses a computer real well, but the only games that she plays are on a touchscreen. And I think it's just because of that low friction. So, you know, I don't know what they'll do next. If the thing that they do next is as what I think, what I would call like genuinely revolutionary as establishing the touchscreen as an actual viable interface, for mass consumption by adults, especially if whatever they do next does that, I will be like flabbergasted and amazed and overjoyed just because it's just that many more avenues for stuff that I make to hopefully reach a wider and wider audience of people. You know, I'm personally really interested in games and business models that have been, there's been some really cool stuff recently. I think Clay's mm-hmm. game Don't Starve and what Introversion's doing with Prison Architect and what Chris is doing with Spy Party and everybody who's doing this kind of like sort of pre-order, semi-open development, kind of long-term sustainable approach, where an approach to making and selling stuff to an informed audience that does not rest or rely or hinge on this whole like work on it in secret for 3 years and then obsess over the launch date and we make these games and we make these projects and we try to make things that make other people happy. And when that, the more that business model, the more you can shift the business model to be something that you have some influence over and you have some control over, the more stable you are. And when you start having a mortgage and a family and are just getting older in general, a lot of that stability starts to look really comfortable. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that the release date is predicated upon the notion that you're going to actually ship something. Like, we all call it shipping, but you don't actually physically ship anything. We haven't for years. So all of that can and probably will with time sort of change around. So that's more of a, it seems like you're talking about more of a conversation with people that are gamers that you're.
I hope eventually, like my hope is to kind of mix, there's so much about that business model that I like. And then right now I do think it's a very super dedicated, hardcore audience that participates in that. And I really like the idea of, applying all of the things that I apply when I'm thinking about do the humanist version of that, like do a thing where, you know, there are lots of normal folks engaged in following along with the development of a thing and giving feedback and, throwing out ideas and just like broadening. If you can broaden the pool of players and the people contributing ideas to something, that just seems like really automatically interesting.
That's exciting. I'm looking forward to see what you come up with.
Yeah. I mean, I might just make another game about blown up aliens.